quite sure why this topic was chosen, actually, but obviously someone was interested in the subject. So I'm sorry it looks a little bit formal for me to be standing up here. I would have preferred to be down there, but the trouble is that I've got some overheads that we need to use, so I hope you don't mind if we sort of look a little bit formal here, and I hope your necks don't get too sore having to look up there from the front. I think it's really quite interesting the way the Bible talks about a number of different nations and actually predicts the future for them, because of course this becomes to us one of the great ways of proving that the Bible is true and that other prophecies can be relied upon, because what God has already said about other places has come to pass. In terms of Egypt, we really might say that Egypt is all about the land and the gift of the Nile. Let's see if we can focus this a bit better. So the interesting thing about Egypt is that when we look at Egypt, what we're really looking at is the story of the Nile, because the story of Egypt was always about the story of the Nile River. And of course the Nile River flowed from this area here. There were three great tributaries to the Nile. There was the White Nile from Lake Victoria in Uganda. There was the Blue Nile that flowed from the highlands of Ethiopia. And there was a third tributary called the Akbara. And they all met further back here in the land of Sudan, and then flowed down through the region of Egypt. Pretty unusual river, actually, the River Nile, because you'll probably know that most rivers, as they flow towards the sea, do they get larger or smaller? Generally, they get larger for the simple reason that other tributaries are adding further water to the river as it goes. Well, the Nile is the opposite. The Nile actually gets smaller as it heads towards the Mediterranean here. And one of the reasons for that, or two reasons for that, are that once the three great tributaries have joined together off the bottom of the screen here, back in the land of Sudan, not one further drop of water is added to this river before it hits the Mediterranean, neither by means of tributaries nor by the rain of heaven. And during that time, of course, what the river is doing is fertilizing this tremendous stretch of green belt all the way down through this area, and therefore getting progressively smaller as it heads towards the Mediterranean. But in the process of doing that, it fertilizes this tremendous area. In fact, what you've got there is the fact that 97% of the population of Egypt live on 3% of the land. So, you know, the whole story of Egypt is really focused around this line here. That's Egypt. 97% of the population on 3% of the land. That's where the whole history of the nation has come from. And you can see here reading from Jeremiah 46, verses 7 and 8, how that the river and the nation are almost seen to be synonymous terms or ideas. Who is this that rises like the Nile, like rivers of surging waters? Egypt rises like the Nile, like rivers of surging waters. She says, I will rise and cover the earth. And so the very river itself became a symbol of the nation. And the swelling of the River Nile, the increase of the River Nile, became a symbol of the increase of Egypt's power. And the drying, or the drought on the River Nile, became a symbol of the wasting of Egypt's power. And the whole story focuses around the story, you see, of that particular river. 2 months of every year, what would happen is that the River Nile would flood. And as it did so, of course, it would bring down those wonderfully rich and fertile deposits of silt and alluvium that would feed all of that area from which Egypt was fed and from which they took their riches. In fact, Egypt felt themselves to be a fairly secure nation because, really, of the very context of their land. Because in the uppermost regions here, there is a set of very dangerous waterfalls that makes it pretty difficult for any attacking force to come down the river this way. And so their southern border was protected by those waterfalls that really cut off the nation in terms of being easily accessible from the river. On the northern end of the river, in the region here of the Mediterranean, this whole area known as the Nile Delta was a tremendously marshy area and very difficult to actually maneuver through. So it was impossible for an army to conquer Egypt by coming in from the north and attacking through the Nile Delta. It was just too boggy, too marshy, too dangerous. And on the other side of the Nile, on both the east and western sides of where the main population base was, there was nothing but sheer, inhospitable desert. So the nation felt fairly secure as it rested in its history and in its future around the River Nile. And there in that place, this nation built one of the greatest organizations and one of the greatest people, one of the greatest nations, really, of ancient history. Let me just tell you one or two things about the greatness of Egypt in the past so that we can measure this against Bible prophecy. You've probably heard of the pyramids, and the most famous of the pyramids, the Pyramid of Cheops or Khufu. That particular pyramid covers 13 acres. Now, 13 acres is quite a big sort of area, and of course they built the pyramids level so that the exact structure is absolutely balanced in every way, and it begins with a level platform at the bottom. It's going to be level at the bottom. Now, over 13 acres, that particular platform for the Pyramid of Cheops is level to within 2 centimetres. 2 centimetres. Over 13 acres of territory. That's not bad. In fact, it's pretty amazing. In fact, one of the problems about the pyramids is they can't quite figure out, of course, how it was all done. It contains 6.25 million tonnes of stone. And each stone weighed something between 2 to 15 tons. And every block, well, in order to build the number of blocks needed, and I've heard all sorts of different theories on how it was done, including a Jew, I think, that suggested it's liquid rock. I think they are real blocks. The blocks that were there in that one pyramid alone, and of course you realize there's dozens of pyramids, but in that one pyramid alone, you would have needed to have fashioned a block between 2 and 15 tons in size, cut to precision, every 2 minutes, night and day, for 23 years, just to have enough stones to build that one pyramid. Absolutely amazing. How did they do it? The Egyptians were famous for their, you'll notice here in terms of their chief exports as an ancient nation, they were famous for their linen. In fact, the linen of Egypt was known as byssus, and it was the most fantastic linen ever seen in the world. It was so fine, so sheer, that they said that it felt like silk. You could hold a piece of Egyptian linen up, and it was so delicate that you could see through it. It was so famous and so prized that Egyptian linen was sold for its weight in gold. They've never been able to figure out in modern times how they actually wove that linen. They don't know how they did it. And as with weaving, so with spinning, they were famous for other things they did, including the manufacture of fishing nets in ancient Egypt. And these nets excited the admiration of all around the world for their incredible fineness and strength. And they would actually weave these fishing nets with such amazingly small, you know, holes, and so fine were the threads that you could take an entire fishing net and it was so delicate that you could pull it through a signet ring. A whole fishing net for a ship pulled through one signet ring. They don't know how they did it. They don't know how they're able to do such incredibly delicate work. They had amazing skills with dyes and with acids. They were able to dye garments and to colour cloths so brilliantly and permanently that the techniques that they used in ancient Egypt have only recently been found and only recently been copied in comparatively modern times. The arts of ancient Egypt somehow were lost down the track. And the same in the area of tanning and leather work and cutting of leather and embossing. They were famous for all of their skills in this particular area. They knew a lot about metals, did the ancient Egyptians. They knew how to harden or to temper bronze. They had special techniques to handling bronze in such a way as to make it incredibly strong. And yet they also knew how to do something else with bronze. They could make bronze an elastic metal. They could turn bronze into a metal that would stretch and pull. Nobody knows how they did it. They also knew how to treat bronze and other metals in such a way that they would resist oxidation or corrosion. And they have dug up metal ornaments and metal urns and metal vases and so on and so forth in Egypt that are thousands of years old and yet sparkle with absolute brilliance because there's not a mark of corrosion on them. No one knows how they did it. It's a mystery to the moderns. They possessed the secrets for quarrying and cutting stones that defy modern cutting instruments. The French found an obelisk in Egypt. You know what an obelisk is? It's one of those great big long skinny sort of, you know, pillars. And the French decided that they would take this home. And they found this obelisk carved out in a quarry in Egypt. All they had to do was cut the base. Was already completely finished. All they had to do was cut the base and then haul it away and take it back to France as one of the spoils of plunder. Well, they spent weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks trying to cut the base. They couldn't figure out how to do it, let alone how to actually carve the obelisk itself. They have no idea how they actually did it. They were brilliant at furniture design. They were brilliant at sculpture. They were brilliant at painting. They knew other secrets as well. They were acquainted with mining, with crushing of quartz to extract gold. They had advanced smelting techniques. They knew how to manufacture gold leaf. They could weave patterns of gold wire so fine and so minute that the details of the crisscrossing of the wires were impossible to see with the naked eye. And therefore they believed that they knew how to actually deal with metals under the process of magnification. They knew how to produce semi-precious stones. They knew how to create synthetic precious stones. They knew how to fuse gold and glass together. They were able to glaze gold with a coating of glass. They still can't do that in modern times. They have no idea how the ancient Egyptians actually managed to do that. They knew about chemistry and metallic oxides in the manufacture of glass and porcelain. You know, they found this little fragment of a bird, a glass fragment of a bird. And what it shows is the circle of the eyeball of the bird and part of the plumage of the wing. You imagine this little glass bird. You can see the eyeball and you can see the wing. You can see all the little feathers on the wing. It's all done in glass. And the way it's done is it's been fixed in the glass by alternate slivers of glass of different colours to create the look of a feather and to create the shape of an eyeball. And it's all melted into clear glass with the coloured glass slivers somehow embedded in the clear glass. But the tricky thing about it is you can look at the bird on both sides and it's exactly the same. It's absolutely perfect all the way through. They have no idea how they actually managed to do that in terms of the glass fusion techniques that were there. They knew how to make glass elastic. The ancient Egyptians were able to produce glass that could be pushed and pulled. They're still not sure quite how they did it. They knew about chronology, they knew about astronomy, they knew about engineering, they knew about medicine. Look, I'll tell you what, we're dealing with one of the most amazing nations ever in the history of time. And yet this is the nation of whom God said, well, let's have a look at Ezekiel 21. I mean, this is the fantastic story of an unbelievably gifted and talented nation. And yet, for all of that, this is what the Bible says concerning that particular people. So, Ezekiel 29 and verse 1. In the 10th year, in the 10th month, in the 12th day of the month, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and prophesy against him and against all Egypt. In fact, he's called, in verse 3, the great dragon that lieth in the midst of the rivers. Interesting, actually, because at the time that this prophecy was given, in the days of Ezekiel, what had happened was that the capital of Egypt had moved. The capital of Egypt used to be in Thebes. And then from Thebes it moved to Memphis, and then from Memphis it moved to Sais. And at the time that this prophecy was given in Ezekiel, the great capital of the Egyptian kings was Sais. And Sais was right in the middle of the delta area of the Nile, with all these little rivers going all over the place in every direction, and the capital was right smack in the middle of all those rivers. And you see what Ezekiel 29 verse 3 says. Behold, I'm against thee, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great dragon that lieth in the midst of his rivers. That's exactly true at the time that this prophecy was uttered in terms of the capital of the king of Pharaoh, which hath said, my river is mine own, and I have made it for thyself. And so here we have one of the great judgments uttered against the nation of Israel, of Egypt. And here's why they were judged. Verse 6, and all the inhabitants of Egypt shall know that I am Yahweh, because they have been a staff of reed to the house of Israel. When they took hold of thee by thy hand, thou didst break and rend all their shoulder. And when they leaned upon thee, thou breakest and made all their loins to bear to stand. Therefore, so you see what Ezekiel 29 says. The basis for God's pronouncement of judgment on Egypt was that they failed Israel. You see, because at the end of the day, God's interest is in Israel, his people, and his nation. And the fate of the other nations of the world rests upon how they do or how they do not do in terms of their relationship with Israel. This is really part of the outworking of a much earlier curse or blessing. Which is what, by the way? An earlier curse or blessing on the nations. I'll bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curse thee. And that is outworked now in the judgment against Egypt, because when the crucial moment came, says verses 6 and 7, they let down the people of Israel who turned to them for help. By the way, what's the dragon in verse 3? You know what the dragon is in verse 3? Not too tricky to work out. What's the great dragon of verse 3? Thoughts on that? Does anyone know the sacred animal of Egypt? Sorry? It is the crocodile. Absolutely correct. It's the crocodile, yes. In fact, so sacred that they actually built a city in Egypt, in ancient Egypt, dedicated to the crocodile. And you wouldn't believe what it was called. It was called Crocodopolis. So is the dragon here is the symbol of the great crocodile, the Egyptian crocodile, lying in the middle of his rivers, a symbol of the might and power of the Egyptian king. So here these two prophecies, Ezekiel 29 and Ezekiel 30, are a prophecy of the desolation of Egypt. Firstly, I'm against thee, and I'm against thy rivers, and I will make the land of Egypt utterly waste and desolate from Migdol to Syene, even under the border of Ethiopia. And then chapter 30, which says, and I'll make the rivers dry and sell the land unto the wicked. I'll make the land waste and all that therein by the hand of strangers. So notice that both these prophecies say that the land of Egypt would be made waste by God, and in fact desolate by God, and that the way in which the land would be made waste is by the river being made dry. And the drying up, you know how we talk about the drying up of the river Euphrates in the book of Revelation, which symbolizes the drying up of a certain political power. Well, here the drying up of the river Nile is also symbolic of the drying up of the power of Egypt as a nation. Now notice what it says: from Migdol to Syene. Now I don't know if you can see up here, but Migdol was right at the top of the Nile Delta, just as one came into the Mediterranean. Whereas Syene, which was known as Jebu to the ancient Egyptians, was right on the border between Egypt and Nubia, and was in fact the southernmost point of ancient Egypt. So when Ezekiel 29 verse 10 says, I'll make the land of Egypt utterly waste from Migdol to Syene, it is a prophecy of the complete and utter destruction, or the complete and utter desolation, of the entire area of ancient Egypt. The whole place was to be overthrown from the very length and breadth of the land, from Migdol to Syene. And in fact, what we have is a set of prophecies that not only predicted the desolation to come upon Egypt as a whole, but also upon specific cities in the land of Egypt. And here are two specific ones. So, you know what the two most famous cities in Egypt, from a biblical point of view? Probably a bit tricky, really, that question. Well, here's the first one. First one is Thebes. Well, it used to be called Thebes, but in the Bible, Thebes is known as... You know what Thebes is called in the Bible? No Amon. So, that was its Hebrew name, and that's as shown on the map here. And so this was the first great capital of Egypt. And so we've got a prophecy in Jeremiah 46, and one in Ezekiel 30, and a comment in Nahum chapter 3 that all predict the overthrow of Thebes. Now Thebes was called No Amon, which means the portion or abode of Amon. And it's generally just called No in Scripture. You've got to be careful with that, by the way, because I remember someone reading from Nahum, and he didn't quite realize that the word No was the name of a city, and he was reading with great drama and power, and he said, art thou better than populace? No! And then couldn't quite figure out how the rest of the verse went, because he misread No. It wasn't actually a No, it was No as in the place of the city. Now what's interesting about this place, No, Amon, is that there were 100 gates into the city, so great it was in ancient times. Tacitus says, who's a great historian, says that the city of No could field alone an army of 700,000 men on behalf of Egypt. Can you imagine that? That one place, that one city, was able to provide 700,000 men to fight on behalf of Egypt. It was a fantastic place. And the city straddled both sides of the river and boasted a stupendous number of temples. On the west side stood the vast temple complex of Hatshepsut, the Valleys of the Kings and Queens. Anyone heard of the Valleys of the Kings and Queens? You know, where all the great burials have been discovered? Well, that's at Thebes. On the east side there were the vast temples of Karnak and Luxor. There are obelisks and statues. There are giant columns and portals. In fact, you know, when you go to Thebes, you feel as if you're walking in the land of the giants. You feel as if there was a giant race that must have lived there, because everything's so enormous. Every pillar, every temple, every block, every statue is just so huge, so vast. It's like the land and the place of giants. In fact, one writer says this concerning Thebes: such vast and surprising remains are still to be seen of such magnificence and solidity as may convince anyone who beholds them that without some extraordinary accident they must have lasted forever. To suggest the fall of such a mighty city would have seemed outrageous in the prophet's day. But what actually happened was this. In BC 525, Cambyses the Persian captured Thebes with a very ferocious assault upon it, and he consumed many of its temples with fire. And as a result of his capture and his semi-destruction of Thebes, the Egyptians moved their capital down the river to Memphis, down here, and Thebes ceased to be the capital as a result of that. But it still remained as a city. And then in 89 BC, a chap called Ptolemy Lathyrus, who was Cleopatra's grandfather, laid siege to Thebes, which resisted for 3 years against him. But when finally he conquered the city, he leveled it to the ground. The inhabitants of the city never returned, and the whole area was broken up, and today is still divided into simply a handful of little villages amongst the ruins of that great city. And those prophecies came exactly to pass. And yet at the time that the prophets uttered those words, you just would not have believed that that would take place. But they did. After an astonishing set of circumstances that no one had anticipated. And the other great city of Egypt from a biblical point of view is the city of Memphis, which was the great capital after the movement of things from Thebes down the river. And so here now we have some prophecies against Memphis, which in the Bible is called Noph. It's called Noph because it used to be called Pa-Noph. The Egyptian name before Memphis was Pa-Noph. And it was known as Noph from the biblical point of view. And it was known as the great temple city of Egypt. It succeeded to the capital when the decline of Thebes began. And it was the centre for the worship of the god Ptah, and for the emblem, the great emblem of the Apis bull, which was famous in Egypt. And because of its strategic location and its religious associations, it continued to prosper even after the capital had moved to Sais later on. And so what happened was that gradually the capital moved down the river again further to Sais, but Memphis still remained because of all the temples and because of all the idols that it had. But what happened was, from AD 379 to 395, the Roman Emperor Theodosius ordered the destruction of the temples and the desecration of the statues and the idols, and he pretty well wiped Memphis out. But what he didn't do was actually remove all the statues and idols. So he destroyed everything, so Memphis was just a terrible mess, with statues and idols and rubbish lying everywhere. But the whole of the city was still there. And yet these prophecies had specifically said, and you notice this, I will destroy the idols and I'll cause their images to cease out of Noph. So here was a prediction in the Bible that these things would be removed. Now when Theodosius came through, he certainly destroyed the city, but all the idols and all the images were still left there. And then something happened in the year 969 AD. A city, a very, very famous city, was founded on the banks of the Nile, just a few miles to the north. It was founded on the east bank. So which way is east? It's got to be this way, doesn't it? Just a few miles north of Memphis on the other side of the river. A little bit up, and across the river. Incredibly famous city. Now that one's still around, so what's the name of that city? Not too hard. Yeah, that was Cairo. Cairo was established in AD 969. And as they started to build Cairo, they needed sort of building material. And they said, we know a good place where there's building material. What about Memphis back down the road here? And so what happened was that the stones from Memphis provided building material for the development of Cairo, and as a result of that, Memphis was gradually destroyed, statue by statue, and idol by idol, and block by block, because it was all removed to Cairo. And the words of the prophet came true, because in fact the idols and the images ceased out of Noph, because the whole lot of them were actually taken away, they were removed. In fact, I've been to both Memphis and to Thebes, and so I've seen exactly what they look like. And you go to Memphis, and the only thing that's left in Memphis today is a huge statue of Ramesses II lying in the dirt, an alabaster sphinx, and a few handfuls of broken pottery, and that's it. It's all gone. Nothing else left. The whole place has absolutely just disappeared, as if someone waved a wand over it and everything just flew away. Well, it did. It flew away to Cairo. But no one would have expected at the time that that was actually going to happen. Now, you see, to me, these predictions, what it was like was predicting that either New York or Tokyo would be made desolate. Now, can you imagine making that prediction? Imagine if we stood up today and said, in yet a year, Tokyo shall be destroyed and there shall be no trace of it. Now, who would believe you if you stood up and made a prediction like that today? People say, well, you've got to be nuts. Well, that's exactly what it would have been like when these prophecies were made, because that's how important and that's how big and that's how real these particular cities were at the time, and yet these prophecies were made and turned out to be terribly and yet amazingly fulfilled. So, are you still in Ezekiel 29? Let's have a look at what Ezekiel 29 says. And this is what was going to happen. Verse 13. Yet thus saith the Lord God, at the end of 40 years will I gather the Egyptians from the people whither they were scattered, and I'll bring again the captivity of Egypt, and I'll cause them to return unto the land of Pathros, into the land of their habitation, and they shall be there a base kingdom. It shall be the basest of kingdoms, neither shall it exalt itself any more above the nations, for I will diminish them, that they shall no more rule over the nations, and they shall be no more the confidence of the house of Israel, which bringeth their iniquity to remembrance, when they shall look after them, but they shall know that I am the Lord God. And so here was the prediction that although after terrible judgments Egypt would be restored, that it would never again find the greatness that it once had. It would never rise to the level of brilliance or genius for which it was once famous. And to me, the most amazing thing of all in terms of these prophecies concerning Egypt has been the terrible way in which that particular prophecy of verses 14 to 16 has been fulfilled. How can you have a nation that must have been the leading nation of ancient times turn into the place it is now? I mean, it's just not the same place. It's not the same nation. It doesn't have the same skills, doesn't have the same power. It's gone. They do not have that genius anymore. And that's exactly what the prophet had said. It said, yes, Egypt will come back and Egypt will be re-established, but it'll never have its preeminence in the way that it once did as a guide and a leader amongst other nations. I want to just show you a little cycle here, because this is really why what happened, and what we think in fact is going to happen again, because I believe that all of these prophecies in Ezekiel are going to actually be fulfilled a second time, and that what we've seen already in Egypt is going to happen again. There's going to be a latter day application to the prophet's words. Of course, mind you, the fact that they've already been fulfilled gives us confidence concerning the latter day applications. But here's why, because you see, there's a story being outworked here. Now, here are the four stages from a biblical point of view of what's happened in terms of the relationship that Israel has had with Egypt. Firstly, you have the story of Israel being invaded by a northern army, and Israel then seeks help by means of an alliance with Egypt. And then they find that that alliance is not as good, Israel finds that that alliance is not as good as they had hoped or wanted, that there are some breaks in the chain, and that Egypt only offers a token support after all, and did not become the support that they had promised. And finally, the invading power that has swept in from the north and invaded Israel moves even further south and invades Egypt herself, who then, of course, can offer no help to Israel whatsoever. Now, you see, that particular story has been outworked in history more than once. Give me at least two scriptural examples of that story being outworked. Can you give me two scriptural examples of that cycle being outworked? Two obvious ones. So make sure you've got the chronologies right. So a northern power invading Israel. Israel turns to Egypt for help. Egypt's useless in terms of helping. Finally, Egypt herself is invaded. Any thoughts on that? Well, there'd be two obvious historical moments of time when that happened. The first one was the Assyrians. The second one was the Babylonians. Who was the mighty power that came from Assyria? Who was the great king that came sweeping down against Israel from Assyria? And the answer is Sennacherib. And we're told in Isaiah 30, the prophet warns against those in Israel who sought to make an alliance with Egypt. And they turned to Egypt to try and have some political and military support as a result of the coming invasion of the Assyrians. And what happened is when the crunch came, Israel didn't help at all. And ultimately the Assyrian power reached even into Egypt itself. And that whole story, that whole cycle of 4 points was outplayed in the history of the invasion of Israel by Sennacherib, king of the Assyrians. And then later on, another famous king came down, and the whole story was repeated all over again. And who was that? Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And the Babylonians came down, and they did the same thing. They invaded Israel, and some in Israel turned to Egypt for support, and they found that Israel didn't support them, and Nebuchadnezzar actually laid his hand against Egypt as well. So this has been the history of the relationship between these two powers. Well, what we believe is that that story is actually going to be outworked yet again, because the Bible seems to indicate that that in fact will be the case. Now, let me just put an overhead up here. I'm going to try and cover some of this so you can't see everything straight off. Now, how am I going to do that? Let's have a look here. Right. Okay, I think I can get most of it there. That's still not good enough. Not bad. Now, this is a modern map, just to show there's been a few changes. I want you to see if you can pick up the changes on this map. How is this map different? This is a modern map now of the same area. How is that map different to the map we used for the fulfillment of those ancient prophecies in biblical times? What's different about the map? Sorry? Oh, yes, the S1 dam. Yes, so the S1 dam is here. That's true. Absolutely true. Yet notice that the delta area has changed. Instead of having a whole set of about seven rivers that moved out across the whole delta area, I've only shown two. Why is that? Any thoughts on that? Sorry? Yes, most of the rivers have silted up now in the delta area. So whereas there were about seven lines that the water flowed out into the Mediterranean, most of those have gone now, and there's only about two principal ones left. What about this here? We didn't have this on the ancient maps. What's that there? So here's the Suez Canal coming through here. So the basic line of the river is certainly the same. Now, by the way, what would Aswan relate to in terms of ancient names? Any thoughts on that? Sorry? Wasn't there a king of Egypt called Aswan? There could have been, because certainly there was an upper and a lower Egypt, and certainly part of Egypt was ruled from that territory. Okay. Yes, I think that's right. I'm just trying to see if I can superimpose one of those earlier maps over the top, see if I can do that. I don't know whether I can. I don't think I've got one that has the right things on it, unfortunately. That's a pity. Yeah, I haven't actually got one that quite does that, but let me just see if I can delicately position this over the top and sort of make it work. Just hang on. Yeah, well, you'd be pretty close, wouldn't you? Let me move this to where I think they really should be. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. You see that sign there? So it's right over the spot where the Aswan Dam now is. So ancient Syene certainly answers to Aswan on that. So any other changes in terms of that map compared to the old ones? There's one other big change. It's at the bottom of the map. It's not Abu Simbel either, by the way. Sorry? Yes, that's right. That's the dam there. So Aswan is the dam, right? But the other great change to the map is this area here, isn't it? Okay. What's this here? This is the lake. I presume this is what you're saying, but this is the lake that now flows behind the dam. So there are two different changes. One is the dam, and secondly, the lake that now flows behind the dam. What's it called, by the way? That's Lake Nasser, absolutely correct, and we'll come back to that in terms of detail. So there's a few different things there, and so really that's interesting, because when the prophecy said that Egypt would be desolate from Migdol to Syene, that's from the delta area heading into the Mediterranean all the way back to Aswan, which is where the dam is. And so got to be careful with this, by the way, because people think, that's probably a prediction that the dam will burst and that the river will come thundering down, you know, and wipe Egypt out in the process. I don't actually think that's probably how that prophecy will be fulfilled in the future. But I'm going to show you here, I think it probably will be fulfilled, which might be something a little bit different. So let me give you a latter-day application now in Joel chapter 3. Now, Joel chapter 3 says, in verse, would you say Joel 3 is a latter day prophecy? Yes or no? If it is, how would you prove it? Verse what? Verse 9 and 10, proclaim war against the Gentiles. Yes. Verse 17, yes. What about verse 1? in those days and at that time, what time? When I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, when I bring all nations against Jerusalem. That's a latter day prophecy, isn't it, concerning the restoration of the Jews and the battle of Armageddon that will finally outwork its way at the time of the end. Now, verse 16 says, in the context of this latter day prophecy, the Lord also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake, but the Lord will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. Verse 19, and in that day when those things happen, Egypt shall be a desolation. So what's verse 16 all about? Verse 16 is about an earthquake. There's going to be an earthquake. You see where it says the Lord shall roar out of Zion? Do you know where Joel gets that quotation from? The Lord shall roar out of Zion. He gets it from Amos chapter 1 verse 2, which by the way is on the same page of your Bible, just at the bottom. And it says in Amos 1 verse 1, the words of Amos, who was among the herdmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake, and he said, Yahweh will roar from Zion. So the prophecy of the roaring from Zion was related to the great earthquake that occurred in the days of Uzziah. And now Joel quotes the same phrase in Joel 3 verse 16. He says, Yahweh shall roar out of Zion. So it's a prophecy related to a time of an earthquake. And in fact, verse 16 of Joel says, and the heavens and the earth shall shake. Now, in the context of that shaking and that earthquake, verse 19 says, Egypt will be a desolation. Now, come back to Ezekiel 29 again. And what it says is that, well, that's the very key word found in Ezekiel 29. Egypt will be a desolation. You see this in Ezekiel 29, verse 9. The land of Egypt shall be desolate. Verse 10. Well, here's verse 10. Here's the critical verse, verse 10. I will make the land of Egypt utterly waste and desolate from the Tower of Syene, that's where the Aswan Dam is, even unto Migdal. From Migdal to Syene is what the margin says. From Migdal to Syene, even unto the border of Ethiopia. Verse 12, I'll make the land of Egypt desolate in the midst of the countries that are desolate. Her cities shall be desolate. That's the key word all the way through. Desolate, 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 desolate. But I don't think it's desolate by flooding. By the way, that lake Nasser is 550 kilometres long. An average of 6 kilometres wide, that's a fair chunk of water. And I don't think that it's going to come thundering down the Nile. But let me show you something interesting. I think it's probably going to thunder the other way, and I'll show you why. Now, have a look at this prophecy in Isaiah, which we won't look up because we haven't got time. But this is a prophecy of the latter day overthrow of Egypt, Isaiah 19. The waters of the river will dry up. The riverbed will be parched and dry, the canals will stink, the streams of Egypt will dwindle and dry up, the reeds and rushes will wither, the plants along the Nile at the mouth of the river, every sown field along the Nile will become parched, will blow away and be no more, the fishermen will groan and lament, all who cast nets into the Nile, those who throw nets on the water will pine away, those who work with combed flax will despair, the weavers of fine linen will lose hope, the workers in cloth will be dejected, and the wage earners will be sick at heart. You see, this is a prophecy of the latter day overthrow of Egypt. And what's the language all about? Not the flooding of the Nile, but the drying up of the Nile. And you'll find that all these prophecies seem to be consistent, that they consistently talk about the drying up of the Nile. Now let me show you something interesting. Okay, what's that? Anyone know? That's the major fault line that runs down the Aravar Valley. And as it comes down the Gulf here, it actually heads off down through the water here underneath the water. And of course you probably know that the Mount of Olives is smack on that fault line. If you were to rip the Mount of Olives in half, it would cause nasty things to happen on that particular fault line. Another thing that I haven't shown though on this line is that there is another minor fault line that heads off from this one. When this one turns the corner and heads south, there's another one that goes straight ahead. You know what happens if you know what happens if you take that line straight ahead? Goes smack through Aswan. Now what I think is likely to happen, and I have to say this is only my own suggestion, so you know, you've got to be persuaded for yourself. But you see, that fault, that earthquake rift there, it could do two things. It could either send the water going this way, or it could send the water going that way, couldn't it? If the earth was tilted in such a way that this part is lifted up on that cleavage plane so that Lake Nasser drains in the opposite direction, then Lake Nasser would disappear off into the Sudan. If you have a look at the Sudan, you'll find there's some pretty big depressions there that could take a fair dousing of water, and it probably wouldn't do a great deal of damage. Some enormous areas there into which water could drain off. If you drained that water off, though, what would happen to Egypt? If there was a dramatic change like that and the river Nasser suddenly went drained off to the south into the middle of Africa, into the heart of Sudan, and the dam here suddenly has no more water behind it, where there is no water there, the river goeth out. Absolutely right. Yes, excellent proverb. Absolutely. I couldn't have put it better myself. And so therefore you'd suddenly have a terrible drying up of this, wouldn't you? Now, all the prophecies that I've come across in terms of Egypt and their final desolation all seem to me to deal with the drying up of the river, not the flooding of the river. And the drying up, of course, is synonymous of the drying up of a power. And so that's my suggestion, that if the river flowed that way, then certainly that prophecy would come to pass. And so what we really got is this. That's really what the whole of Isaiah 19 is about. Unfortunately, we haven't got time to go through it, but there's a summary of Isaiah 19, the destiny of Egypt in Bible prophecy. Verse 1, she receives salvation from God's host. Verses 2 to 4, experiences the invasion of a cruel oppressor. And by the way, you know Daniel 11, all right, see if you can quote this from memory. The king of the north, king of the south shall push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him. All right, can you take up Daniel 11 from there, from memory? Pretty tricky stuff, really. It says he shall enter into the glorious land. What's that? That's the land of Israel. And then it says, and he shall stretch forth his hand, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And that ancient cycle of the invasion of Israel by a northern power, followed by some seeking of alliance with Egypt, which of course Israel's got right now, haven't they? They've got a peace treaty with Egypt. Followed by Egypt being absolutely useless in the time of trouble, followed by Egypt herself being invaded. Daniel 11 predicts all of that when the power of Gog comes down into the area of the Middle East. And I think that that's the time that this prophecy is outworked, and that during that time, Egypt endures physical and economic chaos, suffers civil and political collapse, learns the might of Israel and their God, converts to the true worship of God, memorializes their divine deliverance, pledges faithfulness to God, becomes a true ally and support of Israel, and finally submits to the preeminence of Israel. And that sets the scene then for the restoration of Egypt in the latter days. And probably on the same basis as Ezekiel 29 verse 13 says here, at the end of 40 years. And so I think there could well be a similar period of desolation at the time of the end for Egypt, but when they finally turn to the God of Israel, then there will in fact be a basis for the restoration of Israel, of Egypt, in the latter days. And so here it is, the last three prophecies that bring all that together, and that's these three here. So what's the final end of the story? The Bible prophesies that Egypt will become a true ally and support of Israel. Isaiah 11 says that the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea, and across the sea there will then be an highway for the remnant of his people. Isaiah 27 says the Lord will beat off from the channel of the river under the stream of Egypt, and the children of Israel shall be gathered. Zechariah 10 says, I'll bring them out of the land of Egypt, and he shall dry up the river, and the scepter of Egypt shall pass away. And so all of these prophecies show the same thing, that Egypt is going to become a key collection point for returning Jews, and that they will be one of the great places where the Jews return to the promised land is from Egypt, and that part of the reason for the smiting of the river is so that that highway may be prepared, and I believe, by the way, it's a literal highway, a real highway, for the return of the Jewish people into the promised land. And when that happens, Egypt will in fact become a true supporter of Israel, and the basis for her restoration will be there, and at the end God will bless that nation. We might just close with Psalm 68. Which says, verse 29, Psalm 68, Psalm of the age to come. Because of thy temple at Jerusalem shall kings bring presents unto thee. So here is a prophecy that the nations will submit to Christ and to the people of Israel. And then verse 30 says, rebuke the company of spearmen. But the margin says, rebuke the beast of reeds. Moffat says, check that brute of a Nile power. This is a prophecy that the very first nation that shall bring presents will in fact be the power of Egypt. And the phrase company of spearmen is really, as the margin says, the beast of the reeds, and it is a symbol of the crocodile power of Egypt. And so the psalm says, let them rebuke Egypt until everyone submit himself with pieces of silver. Verse 31, princes shall come out of Egypt. Ethiopia shall soon stretch out her hands unto God. And so the prophecy says that Egypt will submit, will hold out her hands to God, and on that basis will then be able to be restored to some degree of importance and authority again. Verse 35, O God, thou art terrible out of thy holy places. The God of Israel is he that giveth strength and power unto his people. Blessed be God. The focus is always Israel, and the nations will find that their own destiny is linked to their degree of support or otherwise for Israel. So if God can do that for nations and predict their rise and fall and the entire wiping out of cities and the destiny of a whole people, then he wouldn't have much trouble moving in our lives, would he, to change the destiny of a person. And the destiny of each person is bound up with the same principle, isn't it? Is whether we are related to Israel, for Israel, supporters of Israel, or against. So here endeth the lesson.